Hello, and welcome to the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University. And I just finished having a fascinating interview with Jean Luen Yang, the graphic artist who created Boxers and Saints. Now, usually for New Books in Christian Studies, we look at a book that you could say is academic. Usually it's published by a university press. This is a little different. It's a graphic novel. And I wanted to include this book for several reasons. One is that, first of all, it's grounded in a lot of excellent history, right? As a work of fiction, of course, Mr. Yang does take some, does make a few, changes for dramatic sake. But for the most part, he's doing a really wonderful job of presenting, the Boxer Rebellion from both the perspectives of the Boxers and from the Christians, particularly the Catholics, who found themselves in opposition. And he does, through his artwork and through his story, he does a really good job of showing these different perspectives in a moving, powerful, and poignant way. And as such, I think it does really, he's doing really a great service in helping us to kind of understand this very, very different time period. And in particular, one reason I wanted to include it is that it pedagogically, I think it's really well suited for students. So a lot of people, especially if you're a professor, you're an academic or a high school teacher or even a middle school teacher who's listening to this, this is something you can really use effectively in the classroom, I think. Your students will read it because it's really good. It's not particular, and it's a pretty, I mean, it looks really nice. And it really tells an effective story. And Mr. Yang and I talk about this story, and he gives us some of the insights he had that led him to make it. So I hope you will listen to this podcast and enjoy it, and that you'll go out and purchase Boxers and Saints so you can get the full story. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Mr. Gene Yang about his new book, Boxers and Saints. Gene, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Now, one thing I want to mention to our listeners very briefly is that this is interview is a little bit different than what we usually do. A lot of times we look at so-called scholarly books, academic books. And today we're looking at a graphic novel called Boxers and Saints, which is about the Boxer Rebellion. And I think it falls within our purview of Christian studies. And what I like so much about this book is that it is a very well-researched historical exploration of the time period from multiple perspectives. So I think it's really a great thing, and it's something I actually try and bring into my classes. I like using graphic novels in my class, and I actually use this graphic novel in my honors class. And so I'm really honored to have Gene here with us. So I wonder, Gene, if you could start off by just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So well, first, thank you for using my books in your classroom. Really an honor. I've taught high school for a while now. I know how pressed for time a lot of teachers are, and for you to make time for my books for me. I deeply appreciate it. My name's Gene Yang, as you said, and actually the way you pronounce it is closer to the way it's mostly pronounced in Chinese.
Oh, okay.
But I usually say Yang just because that's Americanized version, right? And that's what most people say. I'm a Chinese American. I was born in the San Francisco Bay Area. I spent pretty much all of my life in the Bay Area. And the way I came to Boxers and Saints was I grew up in a Chinese American Catholic community. When I was a kid, you know, I always thought of Chinese culture and faith and going hand in hand. Whenever people were talking about God or Jesus around me, they're usually doing it in Chinese. And the church that I attended wasn't just about, I think this is true for a lot of ethnic churches in America, it wasn't just about teaching the faith, right? It was also about preserving some of the home culture, at least. So we would have masses and Sunday school just like any other Catholic church, but then we would also do these very Chinese things. We celebrate Chinese New Year. There's a Catholic holiday called or Holy Day, a Catholic Holy Day called All Souls Day. And the way we celebrated All Souls Day was very, very similar to how Chinese have historically honored their dead.
for centuries and centuries and centuries, even before Chinese culture came into contact with Christianity. So when I was a kid, Chinese culture, faith, you know, the Western faith seemed like they went hand in hand. As I got older, I began to realize that there actually is a tension there, that there's a tension between the way, like, Eastern and Western, traditional Eastern and Western views of the world. And as I got older and learned more about history, as I got in college, I began to feel that tension more and more, especially within my own life. In 2000, in the year 2000, Pope John Paul II canonized a group of Chinese Catholic saints. And this was the very first time that the Catholic Church has ever done this. It was kind of a big deal. My whole church flipped out about it. They had all sorts of celebrations. They made posters of the saints. They had special masses and awesome food and, you know, everything. They had everything. So all these celebrations encouraged me. They inspired me to look into the lives of these Chinese saints. And what I discovered was that many of them had been murdered during the Boxer Rebellion, during this war that was fought on Chinese soil in the year 1900. So up until this point, I vaguely remembered what the Boxer Rebellion was from my high school history class. And I think that's true of most history classes in America. You know, the Boxer Rebellion didn't mention it at all. It's maybe a paragraph in the textbook. But after I looked into it, you know, after I looked into this war, what I found was really fascinating. And, you know, it was fascinating on a number of different levels. First, a lot of people consider the Boxer Rebellion the very first media war, meaning that it was the very first war, it was the very first conflict that people all over the globe were following on a daily basis through their newspapers. Second, people consider it a precursor to the two world wars, because the Boxer Rebellion was really the first conflict that was truly global, that involved both Eastern and Western countries. So people, it begins right at the beginning of the 1900s, in the year 1900, and it kind of is a precursor, almost like a foreshadowing of everything else, all the other terrible things that happened in the century that follows. But for me personally, the reason why I latched onto it was that I saw within this conflict a mirroring of that conflict that I've felt in my own life, you know, that conflict between Eastern and Western ways of thinking. The two sides of the Boxer Rebellion, on one side it was the European soldiers, European missionaries, the Japanese, and the Chinese Christians. And on the other side it was this ragtag army of these poor teenagers, both of them were men. They were, you know, boys from 14 to maybe men in their early 20s. And these men were supposed to be farmers. They grew up in farming communities in China, but all of their crops had died. China had just gone through a series of devastating droughts. So their outlook on life was really bleak. They had really short life expectancies. They're mostly uneducated, mostly illiterate. And they're really angry, too. They're really angry that the Europeans had come into China and established multiple communities within China. So to empower themselves, these young men came up with this mystical ritual that involved bowing a certain way and involved controlling their breathing. And they believed that when they performed this mystical ritual correctly, they would be able to call the traditional Chinese gods down to the sky. And these gods would possess their bodies and give them superpowers. And armed with these superpowers, they went and they fought the foreigners. They made it all the way, you know, the rebellion lasted maybe a year, year and a half. They made it all the way up to the capital city of China, where there was this final showdown in the summer of 1900. And after several weeks, they were put down. They were put down by some reinforcements that the British brought in from India.
Right. No, that's excellent. Well, thank you so, first of all, for sharing, you know, your personal connection with this story. And then I thought that was a great encapsulation of the Boxer Rebellion. I never thought about it as being connected to World War One in that way. That was certainly interesting.
It came up in a couple of books that I read about the Boxer Rebellion, that it was kind of a, you know, it kind of foreshadowed all these different things that happened in the centuries that followed.
So then how does and one thing for our listeners, this graphic novel is in two parts. There's two volumes. One is Boxers and one is Saints, hence Boxers and Saints. So you've given us the background. How do you then enter into this conflict with your graphic novel?
Well, I started, so on the research side, I started reading about it simply because I just didn't know very much about it. So I started reading about it. I started researching, you know, for about a year and a half. I would go to my local university library once a week at least. I spent several hours there reading as much as I could about turn of the century China, about the Boxer Rebellion itself. And all the way through, I was looking for a protagonist. I was looking for a hero for the story. I couldn't find that hero because I would read one thing and I'd feel really sympathetic with the Boxers, and I'd read something else and I'd feel really sympathetic with their Chinese Christian enemies, you know, and I just went back and forth and back and forth. And finally, the two-book structure was an expression of this ambivalence that I had, but I couldn't find this hero. The two books, I wanted them to look really different from each other. I wanted them to look and feel really different from each other. Historically, the Boxers went on this long, epic journey, you know, in a lot of ways, their story lends itself a little bit better to comics, to the graphic novel format, because there's lots of action, there's a lot of movement. And then the Chinese Christians on the other side, their story is much quieter. You know, it's where the Boxers went on the long journey, the Chinese Christians mostly stayed in their own villages and just tried to stay alive. They did a lot of praying. A lot of their conflict was internal. You know, a lot of their struggle was internal. So just from the source material, these two books just would have to be very, very different from each other. And in the end, what I like to do when I write is I like to have a motivating question for each book. So for Boxers, that motivating question was, what does it mean to be a hero? And because that was sort of the thing that tied everything together, I wanted to pull visually from heroic storytelling traditions, from things like American superhero comics or Chinese opera or Chinese war epics. And in each of those media, there's a lot of color, there's a lot of blood, there's a lot of violence and action. And for Chinese, I don't know if you've ever seen a Chinese war epic. Have you ever seen one? Like a movie?
Oh, yes, yes.
My favorite is this one. Oh, you have? Okay, great. My favorite is this one called The Emperor and the Assassin.
Okay, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great movie. But Chinese war epics are always super long, full of color and blood, and really, really sad at the end. So that's what I wanted Boxers to be like. Super long, full of color and blood, really, really sad at the end. On the other side, for Saints, you know, I thought that the motivating question ought to be, what does it mean to be a saint? So I thought about this for a while, and I realized that no matter what religious tradition you come from, sainthood, like holiness, is always tied with this idea of humility. On both the East and the West, right? But any world religious tradition, there'll be this link between humility and holiness. So I wanted the second book to just feel much more humble than the first in every way possible. That's why it's shorter. That's why the color palette is much more limited. I had even argued with my publisher to put it on cheaper paper. I wanted the outside to feel like cardboard and the inside to feel like newsprint. They were not into that idea at all. So we didn't end up doing it. And I think in the end it was a better decision not to do it because the book would have fallen apart a lot easier. But the scope of the story too is much more limited. You know, the Boxer in Boxers, the characters go all over the place, and it seems mostly action takes place in these two different villages.
Right. Well, that's one thing. I'm colorblind, so I didn't pick this up, but my students picked up very well this difference you're describing here about how Boxers is so colorful, whereas Saints is a little more gray in areas, a little more monochrome.
Yeah. For Saints, for the color, You know, I didn't do any of the color. I worked with this amazingly talented cartoonist named Mark Pien. She's a good friend of mine, and she also writes and draws her own comics. But because she's such a good friend, she agreed to, she's agreed to color a few of my comics. She did American War Chinese for me, and she did Boxers and Saints. So we worked together on a palette, and she was the one that chose the colors. But what we looked at for Saints was, we looked to sources that I felt like were more humble, you know, than the superhero comics. American independent comics. We looked at a lot of American independent comics. And a lot of American independent comics will use this very limited color palette so that when you're reading them, it gives you the feel of like reading somebody's diary. They use very limited palettes as a way of building intimacy between the book and its reader.
Right. Right. Well, that's very interesting about then how this all kind of came together. And so kind of, if I can go back, you had this question for boxers, what does it mean to be a hero and the difficulty in finding a hero, but you did come up with a protagonist, right? Little Bao. I wonder if you could tell us a little more about him.
Sure. So both of the protagonists are fictional characters. I do have some historical figures in each volume, but the main characters are fictional. The Box Rebellion, began among the poor of China. And just like so much of the history of the poor, it just wasn't very well documented. Nobody really knows for sure how the Boxer Rebellion began, because nobody was writing about them until they got into the major cities of China and came into contact with the Chinese who were in power and the Europeans. I read this book called Origins of the Boxer Uprising, which gave several theories of how the Boxer Rebellion might have began. Talked about the Boxer Rebellion's link with all these different spiritual groups that were kind of roaming the Chinese countryside at the time. And I took bits and pieces from all those theories, and I used it to construct a fictional life timeline, you know, for Little Bao, for a fictional character. So Little Bao's life kind of pulls from a lot of those theories that I read in that book.
Right, no,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as I read your graphic novel the first time, I said, this sounds a lot like History in Three Keys and The Origins. And I looked back to your bibliography, and sure enough.
Yeah. I really like that book, too. I think that from that book, I learned that that book was all about perspective, right? About historical perspective and how different, putting on a different set of lenses will make history look very, very different.
Right. So, I'm sorry, one thing that I did want to mention to our readers, because you talked about, or our listeners, you'd mentioned earlier about the artwork, was it's really difficult as a historian to describe what the Boxers believed and the kind of folk religion and this idea of spirit possession and the importance of operas and this connection between the divine and operas in China. And one thing I loved about, especially the volume on Boxers, was you captured that so well in how you start with Little Bao. And then can you tell us, how does he come into contact then with Chinese opera and with the divine?
Well, this is something that I read about, was that, you know, the Boxers had that belief that they could call down these traditional gods from the heavens, and the gods would possess them. As a lifelong comic book geek, I started reading comics when I was in fifth grade. What I immediately thought of was Shazam. It really felt like ancient Chinese Shazam, you know? These boys become heroes. And what I read in the research was that the way they learned about, because they're mostly illiterate, the way they learn these stories in the first place was through Chinese opera. Back then, they didn't have television, they didn't have movies, they didn't have comic books. What they had were these springtime fairs. Every spring, every couple of weeks, they would have, local villages would gather together to have some kind of a fair. And they would have these traveling entertainers go from fair to fair performing. So of all of these entertainers, the most popular ones were the actors who would perform bits and pieces of Chinese opera. They would take, China has this long history of opera, this long tradition. And the, you know, it's It's very well developed with a very specific style of music, with a very specific style of dress. And these acting troops wouldn't perform entire operas. They would just perform like the most exciting pieces. It was almost like YouTube, you know,
right.
just get the best parts. So that's how these young men learned about their heroes. And as a lifetime comical geek, I immediately saw a parallel between that and my people, you know, and a modern day comic book reader. So these young men, they watch their heroes up on the stage, and they want to become their heroes, just like we do. Like when we, you know, today when we watch our heroes on the screen, a lot of us have that impulse that we want to become our heroes. So what do? We make fancy costumes. We walk around comic book conventions, cosplaying. But for them, you know, it was a much more intense thing. They saw on the stage who they wanted to be. They saw on the stage models of power, and they wanted to embody those models of power. And I think it was very understandable too why they felt that need to empower themselves. Right. So in the book, you know, what I wanted to do in Boxers was to show visually how these young men modeled themselves. How these young men saw themselves. So I actually show visual transformations. When young men perform rituals, their bodies actually turn into the bodies of gods.
Yeah, and I thought that was so effective. And I'm just thinking about this pedagogically because I'm getting ready to teach History of Modern China in I'll start on Monday. And I think I want to get a still of that to put on the screen to explain to students, this is how these people saw this, and this is how they understood things. I thought that was just, that's one reason I like graphic novels, and especially yours, because it really shows that historical lesson very, very clearly.
Well, thank you.
Oh, welcome. Now, so you said you had this broader question, what does it mean to be a hero? And you've brought up this issue of how we want to emulate heroes, right? How does Little Bao try and do that?
Well, Little Bao, you know, all the way through, he's the youngest brother. He isn't taken very seriously when he's a kid. And all the way through, what he really wants is he wants to be included by his older brother. He wants to be respected by his older brother, right? And finally, he gets a chance to do that. He ends up training with this mystical, he's almost like a mystical martial arts master named Master Big Belly, who is actually based on somebody I read about in one of my books. He's actually a semi historical figure.
Okay.
But after training with Master Big Belly, Mao finally figures something out. He finally figures out how to call the Chinese gods down from the skies. He finally figures out a way to empower himself, you know, and the god who haunts him is actually the first emperor of China. I thought it would be appropriate, you know, part of what the Boxer Rebellion was about. At that time, people all over the world were predicting that China was no longer going to be able to remain a unified nation, that China was going to end up breaking up into pieces. And that was in part why the Japanese and the Europeans had established, you know, these different communities there. It was because they were waiting for China to fall apart, and they each wanted a piece when it happened. I just thought that it would be appropriate to bring in the first emperor of China into a story about the possibility of China falling apart, because the first emperor of China was the one that put China together. Before him, China was actually these seven separate kingdoms, and kind of conquered them all and made them into a nation that lasted for centuries and centuries. But in my story, at least, the first emperor kind of represents a temptation to a certain model of heroism that discounts the place of compassion and that sort of presents heroism without any soft edges.
Right. And that leads to kind of a conflict then within Little Bao, right?
Yeah. That does lead to a conflict within Little Bao. That's sort of the central conflict that he struggles with is what does it mean to fight for his own culture? right? What does it mean to defend this culture? And where does the culture end and the people begin?
Right, because that was one thing that really struck me, and I don't know if this was intentional, and this may be me reading things into it, but when I teach world history, I always talk about with Emperor Shi Huangdi, you've got this, he's a legalist, and he hates the Confucians, and he buries them and burns their books. And it almost seemed to me, I don't know if this was intentional, but there was a conflict between Little Bao's Confucian code that said things like, don't lust after women, don't steal, protect the people, and then, of course, respect your father, who he abandons, right? Versus this kind of legalist code of Shi Huangdi.
Yeah. I mean, that was all. Yeah, that's great. That's great that you read that. That's awesome.
Okay. Well, and yeah, to me, that's so Little Bao. He figures out he learns how to be possessed and learns how to have this power. What does then he do with it under the guidance of Shi Huangdi?
Well, he ends up starting the Boxer Rebellion. So, in history, the Boxer Rebellion was sort of the leadership of the Boxer Rebellion wasn't very centralized. It was actually a loose collection of all these different groups of young men. And I allude to that, right, when Little Bao gets into the capital city with his group of Boxers, he realizes that there are all these other groups there. But what I had, the role I had him play in the book was he was the one that just got the whole thing rolling. When after he gets possessed by the first emperor, that's what he does. He goes and gets the whole ball rolling.
Right. And how does he? What's his relationship with the Christians?
Well, I think he sees the Christians in the way that the traditional, like the historical Boxers did, which were that they were devils. They represented. It wasn't just evil that they represented. They really represented a betrayal of a culture. They represented an infiltration of something foreign into Chinese culture. And I think historically for the Boxers, they saw Christianity as something that the Europeans used to weaken to weaken the Chinese, and they saw the Chinese Christians as conspirators in that beginning. The Boxers had a lot of these beliefs about male and female energy, about yin and yang, and they saw that there were a bunch of rumors about these like bizarre practices that the Christians were supposed to do behind closed doors, and a lot of it had to do with manipulating female energy,
right?
And they use those rumors as a way of maybe justifying some of the things that some of the ways in which they treated the Chinese Christians.
Right. Well, and it's interesting that you should mention that because that maybe is a good segue to introduce these people, the Red Lanterns.
Yeah, the Red Lanterns. The Red Lanterns are a historical group. That was something that I read about too. Is most of the Boxers were young men, but there was a small group of young women who fought alongside the Boxers, and they were called the Red Lanterns. And historically, there were all sorts of rumors about the Red Lanterns. There was almost like, I think in a lot of cultures, the woman is considered the other, right? And that was certainly true within Boxer culture. The female body was very much considered the other, and in a lot of ways, it was both an object of desire and an object of fear. And there were all sorts of rumors about how the Red Lanterns had special powers, like they could fly and they could breathe fire, and they were like the strongest of all of the Boxers. So I brought some of that into my narrative as well.
Right. No, that I thought that was really interesting there. And that fits in with this, your other, or one of the other main protagonists is this woman, Mei Win.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about her and her relationship with Little Bao.
Well, Mei Win sort of, she's kind of a love interest for Little Bao. And she, she, you know, because she's a female character, I wanted to explore that dynamic, you know, that yin-yang dynamic with her character. And in the end, she ends up getting connected with Guang Ying, the goddess of mercy. I wanted an identification between Guang Ying and Mei Wen. I think you can look at culture and tradition as a collection of stories, and especially for old cultures and old religions, there's just a lot of stories. You know, there's a lot of stories that make up that culture or that make up that religion, and often. Often, I think if you don't look at the collection as a whole, if you only focus on a part of it, you end up. It just ends up being an incomplete understanding of the human experience. So that was sort of the thought behind Mei Wen. Mei Wen, by the end of the book, represents a more complete understanding of Chinese culture because she understands both. The justice side and the mercy side. You know, she's been immersed in multiple stories from her own culture, whereas Lil Bao is just focused more on one side.
So, in that sense, is she the answer to the question, "What does it mean to be a hero"?
Yeah, I think she's part of it. She's part of it. You know, one of the. Yeah, she's definitely part of it. And the other part of what you talked about is the Confucian understanding of a person's place on earth and a person's place in life. So I really did have Little Bao turn his back on that. I think you know, the first emperor of China is a very controversial figure, right? Different people think very different things about him. My reading of him is that you know, he was in a lot of ways, was really like he was a historical figure in the truest sense of that term. He really made history, you know, and he accomplished things that are almost superhuman. But at the same time, his understanding of what it means to be human it just feels incomplete, you know. And I think in a lot of ways, the boxers mirrored that. Incompleteness. The historical boxes mirror that incompleteness. And I think you can trace it to maybe an incomplete set of stories. The fact that he excised all that Confucian influence from his own culture feels like there's this big piece of what it means to be human that you are ignoring or that, you know, that you're actively trying to rid yourself of.
Right. Right. No, he definitely, and I always feel bad. I mean, his own mom tried to kill him. I always feel bad for him.
He did live a rough life, right?
Yeah. But that one thing I found particularly one of my favorite parts, and I think very well done parts in this, is on page 312 of Boxers, where you have Little Bao, where he's in his possessed form. He looks like the opera god representation of the Qin Emperor. And then he talks about how he had done something. I don't want to ruin it for our readers, but he had done something Mei Wen told him not to do. And he says, "I did it for China." And then she gives her definition of China, which is, "What is China but a people and their stories?" And I thought that was a really interesting way of describing Chinese identity.
I mean that's sort of what I talked about earlier. Where does the culture end and the people begin? You know, it seems like sometimes you try to separate this idea of culture from the people who embody it, and I don't know if it's good to do that.
Right. Well, one thing that just kind of struck me about it, and this goes in because your identity is a Chinese American, is that this is a Chinese identity that can work even when you're living outside of the territory that the Chinese government exercises authority over.
Yeah, I think within my own life, that's always been something that I've struggled with is how, like, what does it mean to be a Chinese American? You know, what is it? Like, I visited China for the very first time as an adult, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And on that visit, things just felt like they still, it felt familiar yet unfamiliar. It felt like something that, it felt like something that I should be at home in, but I wasn't quite at home in, you know?
Right.
The whole trip felt like that. And I think on that trip, I realized that I don't think I'm Chinese. I think Chinese American is like this other thing. It really is a combination of East and West. And I think that so that ambivalence or that that feeling of discomfort shows up in a lot of my stories.
Right, right. Yeah, I've been meaning. I haven't had the chance yet. I really want to read the American Born Chinese. So I imagine you deal more with that there, but I thought it was interesting. That's something I brought up when I taught the class. I was hoping that they would see. So let's see. Could you tell me a little bit more about then? And I'm trying to. This is a little different from our other interviews because I don't want to give too many spoilers to our audience. Can you maybe tell me a little bit about this guy, Father Bay?
Yeah, Father Bay. So here was my intention with Father Bay was that I wanted him to come off as a complete jerk, and then become more sympathetic in things. Father Bay, in Boxers at least, I wanted him to embody a lot of the negative action and the negative mindsets that I was reading about as I was reading about the Boxer Rebellion, you know, a lot of missionaries back then. And what I read was, especially missionaries from certain Catholic quarters, were just really harsh in the way they dealt with the Chinese. Like, they would walk into Chinese villages, and without establishing any relationships, they would just go in and start smashing idols, which seems like, you know, at least from a modern perspective, it's just like such a disrespectful thing to do. To another culture, and because of these sorts of behaviors, a lot of animosity developed within the Chinese against the Europeans. So I wanted Father Bay to embody a lot of that, at least in the first book. In the second book, I was hoping to show a different side, and I wanted to show that, you know, ultimately the thing that he got wrong was that he idealized the Chinese a little bit too much. It wasn't like he looked down on them. It was like he over ennobled them. You know, like he thought of them as these ideal people. And as he got closer to them and saw the same sin that he found in his own home culture, he just felt really disenchanted. And this is something that I read about too. You know, in reading about Christian missionaries a lot. So there was a period of time when Christian missionaries went out. And they went out because they thought of other cultures as deficient, and maybe other people as a little bit below them, right? So they were going to go and they're going to try to bring them up, and then almost as like a reaction to that, I think another set of Christian missionaries went out and they over-idealized the people that they were trying to establish relationships with. So in both of those cases, you know, even though they seem like they're diametrically opposed, the root of it is the same. The root of it is that they see this other culture as something other than human, either more than human or less than human. And both of those cases are, I mean, both of those things are just incorrect.
Right. Yeah, no, I mission accomplished in terms of making him look like a jerk and then making him more sympathetic. I mean, it really, came through, and I really like one thing for our readers that Gene does, I think, very well, or listeners, I'm sorry, that Gene does, I think, really well, is there's lots of neat little details. So, for example, Father Bay in Boxers doesn't speak Chinese very well, and this is reflected in his dialogue. So he doesn't speak grammatically at first, and then later on it gets better, and then he understands what's going on more.
Yeah, and again, that was out of something that I had read about. That a lot of early converts, especially to Catholicism, were criminals. They were actually converting to Catholicism to escape the Chinese legal system, right? And part of the way they were able to do that was through the lack of language skills on the part of the Catholic missionaries. Because there was this language barrier, often the Catholic missionaries didn't understand the nuances of the life situations of the new converts. So they were able to get away with stuff. And that ended up creating a lot of animosity among the Chinese.
Right. And no, I thought he was just a fascinating character, and I do a lot of research on missionaries in Korea, and he just felt to me like so many of the French missionaries that were there. And I think that makes a good segue into Volume 2, perhaps. So here we have the saints, right? And how does – you said Father Bay becomes more sympathetic there. What happens with Father Bay?
Well, I wanted to show that his motivations were I wanted to show that his motivations weren't necessarily from a bad place. That he actually, you know, he came to China with good intentions. I also wanted to show that he had a character arc, you know, that in the end he comes to a deeper understanding of his own faith and of humanity in general than he had at the beginning.
Right, right. No, that makes sense. And that he comes to that realization through his, I think, a lot of times through his relationship to Four Girl, who's, I guess, the protagonist of Saints. So could you tell us a little about Four Girl?
So Four Girl, as I said, is fictional, but she is based on somebody that I know. She's based on one of my relatives. I have a relative that converted to Catholicism as an adult. And like Four Girl, she had a grandfather who hated her. So my relative was born on a bad luck day, according to the traditional Chinese calendar. And because of that, her grandfather just never liked her. My relative also had a younger sister who was born on a good luck day, and their grandfather loved this younger sister. So whenever the grandfather had treats, the younger sister would get them, and my relative just would not. Right. So as an adult, she converts to Catholicism, and she never connects these two things together. Like when you talk to her about her conversion experience, she never mentions how she grew up. The stories are just unconnected in her mind. But, you know, because I know her, I feel like the connection is really obvious. She wasn't able to find a place for herself in the culture that she grew up in. She wasn't able to find a reflection of herself in the stories of the culture. So she began to look to the stories of this other culture, right? And that was a dynamic that I wanted to play with within Four Girl. I wanted her to be somebody who had a hard time fitting in the culture that she was born into. So she goes and looks to another culture for her own place. In my reading too, it seemed like that was true of a lot of early Chinese Christian converts. They some of them converted for practical reasons, but a lot of them converted because they were looking for a place for themselves. And this foreign religion, this foreign community provided a place for them.
Right, yeah, she gets a new name, right? Could you tell our listeners, what's the significance of being named Four Girl?
Well, in traditional Chinese culture, four is not a great number. You know, we have lucky numbers and unlucky numbers. Nine is a lucky number, and four is not. Four is not a lucky number because the way you say it sounds like death, right? Four and death are homonyms. This happened from time to time in China where a girl would be born and they just wouldn't be given a proper name, so they'd be called by their birth order. I read somewhere that I think Mao's first wife had a name like that, had a name that was just a number, but I don't know if the motivation behind that naming convention is the same as I have in the book, but within the book, that, you know, being named after your birth order was sort of a sign of disrespect to Four Girl herself.
Right.
Like a sign that she just doesn't have a place, a proper place in the family.
Right, right. So, and that's really well done, I think, in the graphic novel showing how she doesn't have this place and she desperately wants her grandfather's approval, and that then leads to her to meet a raccoon.
Yeah, that leads her to meet a raccoon. Yeah.
So
So I wanted to...
In terms of why I chose the raccoon, I think I just liked raccoons. I wanted to draw a raccoon. I don't know if I had a different reason than that.
No, it was great. But this is a special raccoon, right? What's special about it?
Well, the raccoon sort of embodies the temptation for her, a temptation to be hard, a temptation to fight against all the injustices that she has in her life.
Right, okay.
To fight against them in a certain way. Yeah, to fight against them in a certain way.
Yeah, it's really strange, because this is a talking raccoon, right? And she sees it as a demon, right?
Yeah, she kind of sees it. She kind of sees that raccoon encourages her to become a devil.
Right.
Her grandfather calls her a devil, and the raccoon encourages her to actually embody that as best she can.
Right. So how does she then go from being a wannabe devil to being a Christian?
Well, I mean, for a Chinese at the turn of the century, that was not that big of a leap, because they called the Christians devils. So Christianity, in a lot of ways, embodied everything that was seen as evil, So ultimately, if she wants to be a devil, the best way for her to do it in her setting was to convert to this foreign faith, to turn her back on her family, to turn her back on her culture, and embrace the religion of the invader.
Right. Yeah, I love this, because then she goes in, so that being said, so she comes into contact then with to Christianity with this guy, Dr. Wan, or is it Dr. Wan?
Dr. Wan, yeah, Dr. Wan.
Okay, Dr. Wan. My main language, second language is Korean, so I always, that's why I got your name somewhat right, because in Korean it would just be Yan. And I want to make him Won, it would be Won in Korean, Dr. Wan. Who's he?
Yeah, he's actually based on a historical figure. So I mentioned earlier that John Paul II canonized a group of Chinese Catholic saints. And one of the saints that he canonized is now known as Saint Mark of China. Saint Mark, like Dr. Wan, was an acupuncturist. He was a lifelong Catholic. He was born into a Catholic family. And he was known for seeing poor people for free. Like, he would treat poor people for free, just like Dr. Wan does in the book. And now for St. Mark, when he was in his 40s, he developed really bad stomach issues, and he ended up treating himself with opium. After that, his stomach issues went away, but he became addicted to opium. And it was an addiction that he struggled with for the rest of his life, but he lived 30 more years. All the way through, he kept trying to kick this addiction, and he just couldn't. They had a very different understanding of addiction back then than we do today. So his parish priest actually excluded him from communion.
Oh, wow.
And for a Catholic, that's a big deal, right? That's like being excluded from your community. That's being excluded from your family. And that's living in a sense, in public shame. And he did that for 30 years. At the very end of his life, the Boxer Rebellion happened. He was killed along with his entire family during the Boxer Rebellion. And on the day of his death, he was still addicted to opium. He never got over that habit. He never got over that addiction. 100 years after his death, the Catholic Church canonizes him. And as far as I know, he's the only addict saint that the Catholic Church has.
Oh, wow.
But I think his life points to this dynamic that even if you're struggling with something, and even if you never get over what you struggle with, your life is still worthwhile.
Right.
You can still live a saintly life. So I wanted to include him in my book. In the end, I decided to change the name because I felt like I had deviated too much from his life story.
Right.
So I don't show any of his kids or his grandkids, and I felt like I couldn't keep his name because I deviated too much. But Dr. Wan is very much based on St. Mark of China.
And so how does he then come into contact with Four Girl?
Well, he comes into contact with Four Girl because, early on, Four Girl develops a devil face. So she figures out a way of configuring her own face so that she looks really monstrous. And her mother's really worried about it, so she takes poor girl to go see an acupuncturist, to go see Dr. Wan. And during that visit, poor girl learns that he's actually Christian because he has a crucifix hanging in his office. Later, when she gets the idea that the best way for her to become a devil is to convert to the sworn faith, she remembers that crucifix and goes back to see Dr. Wan to figure out how to complete her devil training of becoming a Christian.
Right. I thought that was just so funny. That this idea was that she wants to become a Christian so she can be a good devil. I thought that was great, and my students really enjoyed that too. Can you tell us, how did you come up with that idea?
Well, it was just, I just felt like it was in the source material, you know? It was, I guess it was a connection between the stories I heard from my relative and the source material. You know, in the source material, the Christians are just always referred to as devils and demons. It's seen as these embodiments of evil.
Right. No, I thought that was very, very effective. And then she just, she tells Dr. Wan, of course, she wants to become a Christian. Is she then really into the faith?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, she tells Dr. Wan she wants to become a Christian. He's so excited. What keeps her coming back to learn more about Christianity?
Well, yeah, I think it's true for a lot of people who end up becoming religious as adults, you know, including me. I think a lot of us, when we are first introduced to faith, when we first learn about it, we may not have the purest motive. It's not always like, oh, I want to find the meaning of life, so therefore I'm going to go to church, or I'm going to go to this Bible study. Often it's, oh, this church, they give me free pizza, so I'm going to go.
Yeah.
Or there's this cute girl in the Bible study, so I'm going to go. And that was true for me too, right? That was true for me. I always, when I was growing up, you know, part of the reason I went to Sunday school was because my parents made me, and the other part was because there were cute girls in the class. So for poor girl, it's the same thing. You know, she doesn't necessarily have a deep understanding of her faith, you know, when she converts. She doesn't necessarily have the purest of motives in her conversion. But ultimately, she still finds what she wants through her faith and through her involvement in this church community. She finds a place for herself.
Right, right. And I just love it. Yeah, for her, it's gluttony, right? She wants those cookies.
Yeah, she wants the cookies. She wants the cookies.
Exactly. So,
I want to keep going when I was a kid.
Well, this is, again, this is what I really like about this, because I do a lot on history of religion when I'm teaching, and I think students sometimes either have, and it's similar to what you were saying about how missionaries were seeing China, either looking down on something or holding up too highly. And I like that you got that in with this, with her conversion, it doesn't start off really for the best of reasons, though she does later on kind of own it herself.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true for me. I feel like that's true for me. I feel like that's true for a lot of us, right? A lot of us who are continuing to be part of the faith tradition when we're adults. I think for a lot of us, we can see that at the beginning, it wasn't like we had these pure motives, and ultimately things would still turn out okay.
Right. And I thought, especially on pages 64 and 65 of your book, where you had this conversation between her and Father Bay, where she confesses that she did this really terrible thing. I won't tell the readers or listeners what it is. You have to buy and read the book to know. But she confesses that she's done this really terrible thing. And she wants to know if that will be forgiven through baptism. And Father Bay says it will be. And I just wanted to note, because I thought this was just really effective in the terms of the art, how her facial expression changes and how she skips away and is very happy about this. I just wanted to mark that as something I thought was really an effective scene.
Oh, well, thanks. That wasn't something I made up. That was something I stole from somebody else, from a friend of mine, who eventually converted to evangelical Protestantism. When he was in high school, he had this kid in his class who just picked on him constantly, and he actually hoped in his heart for something bad to happen to that kid, and eventually something did.
Oh, no.
Something bad happened to that kid, and he just lived with that guilt for a long time. And it was a part of his, it was a part of his faith journey. That piece was part of his faith journey. So I thought that was a really interesting dynamic that I wanted to play with within fiction.
Right. Well, no, it came through very, very strongly. So one thing I thought was also, I do a lot with studying Korean martyrs, and a name that always comes up is Bibiana. The Koreans, I don't, in your book, it's Bibiana with a V, but Koreans don't have a V, so it's Bibiana. And that becomes Four Girls' new name. So I'm just curious, is there a reason why you chose that particular name for the saint?
Well, I chose it because the root of it is life, right? Viv is life. So
okay.
The four girl, the root of the four is death. The root of her new name should be life.
Okay.
But you know, after I chose that name, and there is a historical Saint Bibiana within the Catholic Church, the Roman martyr from the early centuries. But after I chose that name, I realized that Saint Bibiana is actually the patron saint of Los Angeles. Not that that's connected with the story in any way, but I just thought that was
kind of
cool.
That is interesting. Yeah, she keeps coming up in, I think maybe two of the Korean martyrs that are saints are Vivianas, at least two. And they tend to be perpetual virgins that then got killed.
Okay.
So that's,
well, that's stupid.
that's why that came up. But I thought that was really interesting. Now, the saint, though, that's the most important, in a sense, in this work is a different saint, Saint Joan of Arc.
Yeah, Saint Joan of Arc, I've always liked Saint Joan of Arc. I think a lot of us do, just because she's such an interesting character and such an embodiment of contradiction. What I found myself doing when I was researching the Boxer Rebellion is I kept feeling like the Boxers were like Joan of Arc, or Joan of Arc was like the Boxers. You know, here they're both teenagers, they're both powerless. They come from the lower rungs of their societies. They're both really angry about a foreign presence within their homeland, and then they both empower themselves with these spiritual beliefs that as moderns we would find kind of weird. So in a lot of ways, I thought, you know, The boxers were like Chinese Joan of Arc, or Joan of Arc was like a French boxer, and I thought I could use that dynamic to create some tension within Bibiana's life. You know, so early on, I have Bibiana, I have a vision of Joan of Arc. You know, and at the end, I wanted there to be this question: what does it mean for her to pattern herself after Joan of Arc? Does it mean that she should become Catholic like Joan of Arc was? You know, or does it mean that she should defend her culture against this invading force, like Joan of Arc did,
right.
Like the Boxers are doing?
Right, and that came through really well, and I thought that was very powerful. And I would love to ask more about it, but I want to shy away because I want our, like I said, I want our listeners to buy and read to see what happens, because it is really, really well done story in terms of that question: what does it mean to be a saint? Maybe a question, though, I can ask that won't be too much of a spoiler, though, is that Guan Yin comes back in this story. How so?
Yeah, well, years ago, I went to the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, and I saw this painting of Guan Yin, of the Chinese goddess of compassion. It was an ancient, ancient painting, centuries and centuries old, and it showed her in the middle of the painting, surrounded by this halo of hands. Within each hand was this eye. Right. In the inscription next to the painting, it said that these hands with eyes in it were a symbol of compassion. The eyes represented that Guan Yin was always looking for suffering, and the hands represented that she was always trying to reach out to relieve that suffering. As somebody who grew up in the Catholic Church and somebody who's still a practicing Catholic, those eyes and hands really looked like crucified hands to me. You know, within Chinese medicine, the eyes are considered holes. Like the Chinese talk about how you have seven holes in your head. You have your two eyes, your two nostrils, your mouth, and your two ears. So the eyes are holes. So the eyes and hands, holes and hands, it just felt like there was something maybe universal within that symbolism. And eyes and hands, you know, you find it in certain types of Jewish mysticism. You find it in certain types of Islamic mysticism. It just seems like there's something very universal about that symbolism. So I wanted to play with that within the book.
Well, I think, and it was really, again, I don't want to be a spoiler, but artistically, I thought it was really interesting how you make this connection between the eyes of Guanyin and the wounds on Jesus' hands, like you just mentioned. I think that's really well done. And it's really a striking part, which, and I think those are the pages where you answer this question, what does it mean to be a saint? And I don't want to spoil that for people, the answer. But I thought it was really, really well done.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
One thing, if I could add, one thing, if I could, I wanted to share something from my class to see if I could get your reaction. The class I taught was called Popular Culture in East Asia. And we read several different manga. We read Akira, and we read Azumanga Daioh. Akira is a Japanese action manga. Uh-huh. Azumanga Daioh is a high school drama. It's cute. It's amazing. It's a high school where there's no conflict.
Okay.
And it's just a very cute story. And what was interesting was, and are you familiar with either of these two titles?
I watched the Akira movie. I've read a few of the Akira volumes. I haven't read anything from the other.
Okay. Well, one thing that was really striking was we read your book last in my class, and the students liked it the most of the three graphic novels. They liked this one the best. And one thing that struck me was that when they described why they liked it, one thing they said was that we could understand it much better. It just made, narratively, it just made more sense to them than the others. So that, to me, on one side, that seemed to me, then it was, okay, well, this is all my students, except for, or actually three of my, all my students were from the West, except for one who was originally from India, but they all were very comfortable, I think, with more of a, I guess you could say, a Western style narrative. At the same time, though, it struck me that in your book, these are where the characters look the most Asian, right? Akira doesn't, no one looks particularly Asian.
Yeah, it's a stylistic thing that was developed in China. Though the explanation, I'm sorry, in Japan, the explanation I've heard is that, you know, the most, probably, arguably the most influential manga cartoonist is a guy named Osamu Tezuka.
Right.
He's most well known as the creator of Astro Boy. And he was a huge Disney fan, so he thought that the appeal of Disney characters rested in their eyes, that they had such big, expressive eyes. So he started doing that with his own characters. That's why Astro Boy has these giant eyes. And the artist that he influenced, the artist that came in the generations after him, kind of took that idea and ran with it. And you end up getting, you know, there's some Japanese cartoons where the characters' eyes are, like, bigger than their heads, you know?
Right,
like,
yes,
they
yes.
Take up, like, two-thirds of their head. but it's sort of a stylistic thing. And what I've read, from my understanding, is that, you know, even though the faces are incredibly stylized and cartoonified, those characters are still Japanese.
Oh, right, right.
Even Sailor Moon with her blonde hair is still just, because it's still seen as Japanese.
Right. Right. I just thought that was, I don't know, there was just something that kind of struck me as very interesting about that, was that, but yeah, thank you for your explanation. That makes a lot of sense. So we've taken up a lot of your time. So I'd like to ask you then our traditional last question on New Books Network. What are you working on now?
Well, I got a couple of projects coming up. Number one is I work on comics for the Avatar The Last Airbender series. Avatar The Last Airbender was a cartoon that showed on Nickelodeon from 2005 to 2008. Nickelodeon licensed the property to Dark Horse Comics, who is continuing the adventures in comic book form. I've been working with them for 2-3 years now, and we have another 3 volumes coming out in 2015. The second project that I'm working on is called Secret Coders. I'm really excited about this. I'm working on it with a really talented cartoonist named Mike Holmes. I'm doing the writing and he's doing the art. And this is my first explicitly educational comic.
Ooh.
It's all about computer coding. I was a computer science major. I taught computer science for over a decade. So this is kind of the melding of my two worlds. I'm taking my teacherliness and my cartooning and putting them together. We're telling the story of a group of junior high students who find a secret school. So it's kind of like Harry Potter in that sense. You know, there's a secret school, but the secret school, instead of teaching magic, teaches computer coding. And we're hoping as our protagonists will learn to become coders, that our readers will too.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, I'm really excited about it. Mike is a joy to work with. His artist just has this energy that just leaps off the page.
Well, thank you again for taking the time to talk to us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. This was great.
Thank you very much for listening to this interview of the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. Have a great day and hope to hear from you again.